This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight,
Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi and German Chancellor Angela Merkel announced that they would continue to work together on what they called major issues of international importance.
That's reporter Josephine McKenna reporting on an EU summit in Rome regarding the migrant crisis. Details coming up.
Also, a top intelligence official told VOA that pro-Islamic State Somali militants have grown in numbers and are receiving financial and military support from Yemen. And a former military ruler of Burundi, Colonel Jean-Baptiste Bagaza, died in a hospital in Brussels yesterday.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, pro-Islamic State Somali militants reportedly have grown in number and are receiving financial and military support from Yemen. Abdi Hassan Hussein is the former director of the U.S.-backed Puntland Intelligence Agency, or PIA. Hussein led PIA until a year ago when he was replaced. Hussein says when the pro-IS Somali faction was founded in October last year, it had about 20 to 30 men. But he says there are now between 100 to 150 fighters. He says Islamic State has started delivering supplies through its affiliate faction in Yemen. The supplies include weapons and uniforms. He says there is also evidence the group has received financial support from Islamic State because it's buying supplies, vehicles, and livestock. It reportedly also invested in the surrounding area by delivering water supplies to a nearby community affected by the drought.
European Union President Donald Tusk is meeting with other EU leaders and officials today in Rome. They're expected to address the ongoing migrant crisis. Another meeting is scheduled for tomorrow at the Vatican. Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi is hosting the first day of the summit. He has expressed concerns that Italy will bear the brunt of the migrant and refugee influx. Many other countries are closing their borders or restricting migrant flows. Mr. Renzi and German Chancellor Angela Merkel held a press conference after the morning session was done. Reporter Josephine McKenna is in Rome, and following developments, she spoke to VOA's Jody Capua.
Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi and German Chancellor Angela Merkel announced that they would continue to work together on what they called major issues of international importance, which does sound a little bit vague there at the beginning. Incidentally, before they met the press, they dined together on ravioli and fresh sea bass and fresh berries at Mr. Renzi's office at the Chigi Palace here in Rome. But when they met the media, they wanted to emphasize that they share a common approach to managing the migrant crisis, and yet they do diverge on a proposal from Mr. Renzi for the European Union to offer financial incentives to countries in sub-Saharan Africa to try and curb the migrant flows, to try and keep the migrants in their home countries. He has sent a proposal to the European Union proposing an ambitious accord with these countries of origin and also a big financial commitment from the EU, which would include euro bonds. And this is something that Chancellor Merkel and the German government is very much opposed to.
So is there any word on where it goes from here? Will there be further negotiations? Does it have to go to the EU Parliament? Do you know?
There are further discussions about the Italian proposal. Initially, when it was presented in April, the European Commission and the European Council was quite favourable, was quite positive. And, of course, this is a major issue for Italy. Mr. Renzi wants to manage these migrant flows, particularly as we're facing a new influx across the Mediterranean going into the summer months. We've already seen a few thousand arrive. A surge seems to be taking place with the closure of that Balkan route. So there will be continuing talks about how to manage that, particularly going into the summer.
Now, I understand this summit will continue tomorrow, but it will take place at the Vatican. Why is that?
The European leaders will be meeting Pope Francis at the Vatican, partly because the Pope is due to receive an award from the European Union related to his contribution to peace and compassion and solidarity in Europe. And this is significant too because the Pope has been so outspoken on the migrant crisis and spoken out so many times about what he calls global indifference to the famine, the poverty and the dire situation of many migrants who are forced to leave Syria, South Sudan and other countries and make that perilous journey to Europe. And we saw him just recently in Lesbos, once again telling migrants they are not alone and illustrating his commitment and his solidarity. So this meeting with European leaders will be significant because it's an opportunity for them to meet the Pope face to face and to hear once again his very strong stance on supporting migrants and creating more opportunities for them in Europe rather than shutting the doors of European countries and trying to send them back home.
That's reporter Josephine McKenna from Rome as she spoke to VOA's Jody Capua.
Also, EU Commission Vice President Frans Timmermans says allowing Turks to enter Europe without visas depends in part on Turkey loosening its definition of terrorism. Turkish President Erdogan is pushing for a broader definition of terrorism. He wants to include scholars, journalists, and legislators who support or lend voice to terrorist organizations. The terrorism benchmark is a major human rights issue for the EU and could jeopardize the migrant deal the EU has with Turkey. Turkey has agreed to restrict the flow of migrants into Europe in exchange for a number of concessions, including visa-free travel. Turkey's prime minister has threatened to call off the deal if visa rules aren't relaxed by June.
Former Burundi military ruler Colonel Jean-Baptiste Bagaza died yesterday in a hospital in Brussels. He was 69. Bagaza ruled for 10 years, beginning in 1977. He was known for his economic reforms as well as his suppression of the Catholic Church. Philip Rent-Jens is a professor of law and politics at the University of Antwerp in Belgium. Reporter William Eagle asked him about Bagaza's legacy.
Bagaza was very much into modernizing the country, and one of the ways he felt he should do that was to modernize and upgrade infrastructure, and mainly road infrastructure. That was very bad in Burundi. What you had mostly were dirt roads, and this was a problem for all sorts of economic activity. So one of the things he did was to start tarring roads, basically, putting tarmac all over the place, which he did quite successfully. And even main roads, like, you know, the main road between Bujumbura and Rwanda used to be a dirt road. And in the Bagaza years, these roads were seriously upgraded. He also did some efforts in terms of economic modernization, plantation, agriculture, some minor industry, but not that much. And we should not forget that Burundi, anyway, is an extremely poor country without much of an economy.
Now, he's also known for cracking down on the Catholic Church. What was behind that?
I think mainly for Bagaza, that was a matter of establishing or asserting control. He wanted to control. He was a control freak, and he wanted to control everything. And the Catholic Church was, in his eyes, and I think to some extent this was true, was a countervailing force. Let's not forget that the Bagaza regime was a pretty harsh dictatorship. And so he tackled the Catholic Church in a pretty aggressive way, nationalizing Catholic schools, prohibiting all sorts of prayer meetings. And this didn't go that well with Burundians. Most Burundians, the vast majority of Burundians, are Roman Catholics, or at least are Christians, and they didn't like the way in which Bagaza was trying to curtail the activities of the church.
You have said that Colonel Bagaza and other military rulers around that time came from the same province and even the same hill in Burundi. Can you tell us more about that? Why so influential, this particular area of Burundi?
The province is Bururi, and since 1965, when President Michombero took power, again through a coup d'etat, I mean, coup d'etat putsches in Burundi are a very common occurrence. There was a putsch in 1965, another one in 76 that brought Bagaza to power, then 11 years later, 1987, Uyoya came to power through a coup d'etat. All those coups were actually bloodless. And all those people they were cousins. They came from the same area. And that shows very well that these were palace revolutions because nothing basically changed. This was about fighting divisions within the ruling clique. Those divisions threatened their position in power. So what they did by taking power, Bagaza, for instance, in 1976, was basically to safeguard the position of that ruling group. But nothing much changed.
After his overthrow in 1987, what became of Colonel Bagaza? I understand that he did head another party and that he was a senator for life.
From the early 1990s onwards, Burundi, like everywhere in Africa, embarked on the process of democratization. And Bagaza was among the founders of one other new opposition party in the early 1990s, and that was Parena. He didn't play that much of a role, for instance, in the peace negotiations in Arusha, which led to the Arusha Peace Accord in August of 2000. But he did play his role, his constitutional role, I should say, as a senator for life, but was not a particularly active senator.
That was Philippe Rentjens, professor of law and politics at the University of Antwerp in Belgium. He spoke to reporter William Eagle.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Swuhib. 17 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. A top intelligence official told VOA that pro-Islamic State Somali militants have grown in number and are receiving financial and military support from Yemen. European Union President Donald Tusk is meeting with other EU leaders and officials today in Rome. They're expected to address the ongoing migrant crisis. And a former military ruler of Burundi, Colonel Jean-Baptiste Bagaza, died in a hospital in Brussels yesterday. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
In Nairobi, rescue workers have found a survivor in a building that collapsed 6 days ago. A spokesman for Kenya's National Disaster Management Unit says they administered oxygen and glucose to a woman who was trapped in her room when the seven-story apartment building collapsed. A six-month-old baby was rescued from the rubble yesterday. Workers continue searching the debris for survivors. They say about 70 residents are still missing. The death toll is now 36. While Africa's emerging economies have experienced huge growth and investment opportunities over the years due to the continent's obvious resources, however, one sector that remains largely untapped offers great benefits for consumers as well as investors. Investment numbers for the past few years show investors moving away from Africa's coal, mining, oil, and gas investments to more value-added services such as business, telecommunications, retail, and consumer activity. One sector that has some investors excited is the insurance sector. Eileen Farges co-heads the African, Latin American, and Caribbean Fund of the Washington, D.C.-based IFC Asset Management Company. She says the story headline for insurance in Africa is how low the penetration is.
Penetration is measured as premiums as a percent of GDP, and in Africa, the average is about 3.5%. Outside of South Africa, which is the biggest economy, obviously, obviously it's really only about 1%. So when you're comparing that to a global average of 7-8% and maybe 10 or 12 in a developed economy like the US or UK, you know, those are really low penetration rates.
She says a well-developed insurance sector is necessary for economic development.
Insurance covers risks and strengthens risk-taking ability. It provides long-term investments. People want to protect their assets. It enables businesses to take on additional risks and fosters further growth. Given that Africa's GDP is still growing, one of the only regions in the world where GDP is still growing at a decent rate, then the insurance industry is going to grow at a multiple of that.
Farges says when you add in the fact that people want and need to protect their health, families, and assets, insurance is a tremendous area for growth. Another huge boost for the insurance sector comes from developing regulations to govern insurance.
So, for instance, if you make auto insurance or liability insurance mandatory, you're going to foster even further growth in that industry. So it's really an exciting place to be and definitely an area and opportunity for growth in Africa in particular.
Colin Kirby also co-heads IFC's African, Latin American, and Caribbean Fund. He adds that most insurance regulation would be country-specific.
For instance, very recently in Angola, they passed a law to make motor insurance mandatory, which is something obviously in many Western countries we're kind of accustomed to. That obviously is it helps insurance companies because it creates a market instantly for it. But obviously the whole idea behind insurance is you're sharing risks across wide populations. So when everyone participates in the insurance sector, everyone can afford motor insurance and spread risks accordingly.
Kirby adds that other types of insurance, such as health insurance, could also become a mandatory benefit that a company in Africa has to provide for its employees.
I think the kind of nature of where Africa is on its insurance development, most of the companies are generalists. You always separate between what the industry calls personal lines, which is property and casualty, really, and life insurance, which is more of a financial protection. But in general, providers of health also are going to provide motor insurance, property insurance, liability insurance, etc.
Farges expounds on her colleague's assessment.
And in developed countries, life insurance tends to dominate the market. But in sub-Saharan Africa, you've got non-life, the property and casualty dominating the market. Life insurance penetration, for instance, in South Africa is below 1% and is very low for health insurance, too, less than 3% of the population. And so there's a tremendous opportunity for growth both in the life and the property casualty sides of the business.
From an investment perspective, the continent is very open to partnering with either international, national, or country-specific investors for insurance needs. Kirby provided an example of a partnership they have with an insurance company in Morocco that already had a presence in Africa but was looking to expand.
Just to give you an idea, we invested in a business in 2011 that was already in 16 countries in Africa and over the course of 4 years added 10 new countries to it with the help of the investment that we and some others made. The benefit of that is that as you spread across these countries, you can first of all transfer know-how. So what worked well in Morocco or in Ivory Coast, you could also apply in Nigeria or Angola. You obviously have more efficiency as a company because you're spreading your skill set across a wider base. So more importantly, you're spreading risk.
Both IFC executives say with a wider pool of customers, insurance coverage can be offered at lower prices, and the lower the cost of insurance, the more the consumer can take on. It's a win-win for both the consumer and the insurance company, they say, because the spreading of risks lowers the cost of the product and it allows companies to develop other useful products and services to go along with it. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
Uganda's government says journalists reporting on the activities of the opposition FDC party will lose their licenses and could be subject to arrest. Tensions have been high in Uganda since the February 18th presidential poll, which saw President Yoweri Museveni elected to a fifth term in office. Elizabeth Polat has more from Kampala.
Thursday was supposed to be a day of protest for the FDC officials and supporters who are demanding an independent audit of the results of the February presidential poll. However, heavy police presence kept people off the streets. Opposition leader and presidential candidate Kizza Besigye remains under house arrest. The Inspector General of Police and the Information Minister held a press conference Thursday to announce that the media is banned from covering what the government is calling the FDC's defiance campaign. They said journalists are prohibited from airing live broadcasts of FDC events, covering their press conferences, or inviting FDC members on talk shows. Robert Sampala, the national coordinator with the Human Rights Network for Journalists in Uganda, says this is a worrying sign.
The profession is very clear about balancing our stories, about giving a fair platform to those in power and those outside of power that have alternative views. This is what the media is all about. So now you're detuning the media only to crusade for the government and government policies. That is not what the media is supposed to do.
The government says it must preserve stability and security. But Sampala says advocacy groups are considering challenging the media restrictions in court.
We've seen journalists being arrested before, even without this ban. So it's going to be just a continuation of the further crackdown. They will devise any means to scare the media, mm-hmm. to intimidate the journalists and harass those that are strong-willed.
Social media has not been shut down as it was during the vote in February, but an official with the Ugandan Communications Commission says it will be monitored for those promoting the FDC. Last week, Deputy Chief Justice Stephen Karuma banned all FDC activities for 1 month. These included the FDC's weekly prayers, which on Tuesday were interrupted by police, who then arrested several participants. Elizabeth Pola for VOA News, Kampala.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports and tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanoff, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpuga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
What's up, Africa? It's Jackson Vunganyi.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Cape Town.
Can I be up front with you? That's exactly what Nadia and I plan to do every Wednesday at 17:30 UTC. Upfront looks at issues that affect you.
Since the world is moving at a faster rate, there's need to have a native computer.
Interesting news.
Canadian man was sentenced for drunk driving after being pulled over in his mother's motorized wheelchair. 35-year-old man was fined and placed on probation.
And of course, music. No clouds in my stones. Entertainment, celebrities, you name it, we'll talk about it.
And of course, we love to hear from you. Send us your thoughts and comments. Our email address is upfront@voanews.com.
So don't forget to check us out every Wednesday at 17:30 UTC on The Voice of America.